but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Well, it's the day before. Here we are, one day away from Oregon, Indiana. What, just a couple hours away from Mariners, Tigers, Oregon State, Wake Forest tomorrow as well. We got a big show for you today, and it's going to be fast moving. I told Steven before the show started, I said, we got to move fast today. We've got guests. We've got a condensed show because we're carrying the Mariners and Tigers pivotal game five right here on 750 The Game coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. We've got Chris Hampton, the Oregon Ducks assistant. He is the co-defensive coordinator and the defensive backs coach. Hampton will be joining us here in just a few minutes. We got John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News talking about the college football weekend in the 4 o'clock hour. The BFT jury will be here. Michael Llewellyn, Craig Burnback. It is going to be a condensed, crunched-down show. It'll be fast-moving. For that reason, I advise you to go slow. You must hydrate on today's show. Steven, you better be hydrating. Stretch out. Can't have injuries.
We got the hydration right next to me. We're ready to go.
Get this going. Hey, by the way, everybody talking about Oregon and Indiana. Nick Saban's talking about it. Kirk Herbstreit's talking about it. Josh Pate's talking about it. Yesterday's show, we had Rob Mullins, the Oregon AD, talking about it. He was talking about the potential for Autzen Stadium. A little bit of expansion, but a lot of upgrading. I see that on the horizon for Oregon. If you read me at johncanzano.com, you have the full details. But more or less, Rob Mullins, Oregon AD, saying in a number of ways that get ready for some upgrades at Autzen Stadium as they will get through this practice facility project. And then in very short order, they will get about having discussion about Autzen Stadium, more suites, more clubs, more premium seating, all of that on the horizon. College game day will be in Eugene. Sabrina Ionescu, the guest picker tomorrow. Kirk Herbstreit talking about how much he loves Eugene.
I've always loved coming out to Eugene. When we first came out here, when Chip Kelly was here, I thought, you know, Eugene, Oregon, how the heck are we going to get there? And then when we got here and we had game day and we're on, you know, live at 6 a.m. local, and I didn't know what to expect. It's dark out, and as far as you could see, were people out there, and I don't know, 10 or 15,000 people at 6 in the morning, kind of like what Cal was like last year. It always blows me away when we go on the West Coast and we get these huge crowds for college game day, and it'll be that way tomorrow. Shout out to Chip Kelly and Phil Knight and what they created initially, Mike Bellotti, because Oregon, I mean, where you're sitting right now, Pat, they are a national brand. Like, it used to just be USC on the West Coast was a national brand. Oregon and their style of play, not just the uniforms, the style of play, the aggressive nature that they created. Dan Lanning, I think, has taken it even to another level. The commitment to the program. I was just over at the softball stadium. You know, Rob Mullins, their AD. The commitment to everything they do here is first class. So I love it. Anytime I hear Eugene, Oregon, I know it's a long haul, but I'm fired up to always come out here.
Few things jump out at me about what Herbie's saying there. First of all, I take offense to the fact that he's surprised that people in the western part of the United States are rabid about their sports. And that always baffles me. And maybe, for me, I'm a West Coast kid, grew up on the West Coast, born on the West Coast, born in the state of Oregon, grew up in California. When I got to be covering Big Ten football in the 90s, and seeing Notre Dame and Ohio State in the country, and the programs in the Midwest, and then I lived in Tallahassee, so I saw Florida State, and I got to see a little bit of the ACC, SEC country. And the thing that jumped out at me is always like, yeah, you know, it's generational there, but it's generational on the West Coast, too. People are excited about their sports, too. Why should you know, it always just kind of baffles me that, like, they have this view of the western part of the United States like, you know, it's unexplored. Like, you know, they don't really get sports. They're not really rabid. Oh, look at people as far as you can see. I have seen the West Coast sports fan show up for big games. And it's true, there's not an unhinged, delusional segment that is as large as that what you'd see in the Midwest or SEC footprint. Like, no one's throwing a Molotov cocktail through a window or killing a historic tree as part of a rivalry. But it is a rabid sports fan that will show up in Berkeley when game day goes to Cal or game day comes to Eugene or Corvallis. I have seen the fans show up in force, and it bothers me that Herbie doesn't think that. The second thing is he puts Phil Knight and Chip Kelly in the same breath as he gives credit for the rise of Oregon, and then he adds Mike Bellotti on the back end of it. I would say that if I were correcting Kirk Herbstreit, it needs to be more of a, hey, credit to Phil Knight, and then a long pause after Phil Knight, and then credit to the people who brought Chip Kelly in, and Mike Bellotti and Rich Brooks, and sort of the progression of Oregon football. And then I probably wouldn't give as much credit to Rob Mullins, the Oregon AD. He's more of a manager of what is happening now, and I mean that without disrespect. He's more of a manager. I would go back and I would look at people like Bill Moose, and I would look at Pat Kilkenny, and then I would say Rob Mullins. They're kind of in that next tier of people as we're handing out credit, because I do think there's something to the fact that Mullins saw Mario Cristobal, saw Dan Lanning, and almost in an accidental way, right? Because he tried to hire Willie Taggart and he left. He tried to keep Mario Cristobal there and he left anyway to Miami. And then he got to Dan Lanning, and he looks really smart for hiring Dan Lanning. But let's not forget that, like, you know, Oregon gave a long-term extension to Mark Helfrich and had to buy its way out of that. It made a bad hire in Willie Taggart. It made a corrective hire with Mario Cristobal. It tried really hard to keep Cristobal, didn't get him. And then it found Dan Lanning. There's a little bit of the accidental zillionaire in there. Like, hey, you kind of found your way anyway. The momentum of Oregon, though, driven, I think, by Nike and Phil Knight more than anything. And somebody asked me today, they said, how come Oregon doesn't sell naming rights at Autzen Stadium? You see a lot of stadiums around the country that have naming rights. And I think the answer to that is pretty simple. I think Oregon has been afraid or reluctant to go out and sell naming rights, because if you're going to put naming rights on Autzen Stadium, we all know that the swoosh would be the thing that you would put up on Autzen Stadium before anything. And it's kind of like Nike's bought the naming rights without buying the naming rights. And I think it would be disrespectful to Phil Knight. We'd be disrespectful to Nike if Oregon went out and said, hey, we're going to sell the naming rights to fill in the blank corporation. But Herbstreit and everybody else, Stephen, what do you make of that? Like, oh, you know, I'm always surprised when I see fans in Berkeley or Eugene. Like, don't be surprised. These are college football fans.
Yeah, I hated that part of it. Yeah, I mean, it's not just the last couple of years that Oregon has shown out when college game day has gone there. It's been all the time. And like you said, when Cal hosted Miami last year for college game day, they show out. They always do. And the West Coast always gets that bad rap of, oh, you know, they're just chill. They don't care. And it's just like, you know what? That's just lazy. It's just lazy, and it goes against the narrative, because I don't think people want to watch the West Coast football because it starts a little bit later, so they're always sleeping. They're always doing those things. It just goes to that whole narrative of, look, man, I'm not going to stay up to watch this West Coast football. They don't know what they're doing. They're soft out here, and that's completely opposite of what Oregon has turned themselves into. They are not a soft team anymore. I did find it interesting. You talked about the Bellotti stuff. It's almost like he forgot Bellotti and then mentioned it, because he said Chip Kelly, and he goes, oh, and Mike Bellotti. Well, yeah, Mike Bellotti hired Chip Kelly. So I think in the grand scheme of things, Bellotti doesn't get enough credit for what he did at Oregon after Rich Brooks left and Bellotti takes over. You know, he really kind of put Oregon on the map once again with the uniforms heading out to Mississippi State back in the day. Like, that was the first time they wore those crazy uniforms. People couldn't, like, who is this team? What are they doing? And all that kind of stuff. So I think Bellotti gets a little no credit there when he deserves a lot more credit.
Yeah, look, Mike Bellotti was looking for an answer, right? He had sort of gotten a little stale and was looking for some new ideas, and he went out and got Gary Croton to come in as his offensive coordinator. He follows that with Andy Ludwig, who lasts three seasons. I remember the headline in the newspaper when Ludwig left, it was three and out. Clever. And Ludwig goes on to do bigger things at Utah and other places as a play caller. And then he found Chip Kelly. And so, you know, it was only by virtue of kind of dabbling around, Bellotti was looking for some other answer. And I got to give Bellotti credit, too, because Look, I had my issues with Blatty. He was the ultimate CEO of a program. He, you know, he is a guy who I think was far more interested in kind of being the CEO than he was rolling up his sleeves and getting into a drill like coaches like Mario Cristobal and others that followed him were. And I mean that as a compliment to Mike Bellotti, because we've talked a lot with Trent Bray at Oregon State about how he needs to be more of a CEO. Bellotti was a CEO. And I often said late in Bellotti's tenure that I didn't know how much he really enjoyed kind of the day-to-day of being a coach as much as he enjoyed being the CEO of the program. And so I think it worked for Oregon at that time because you had tremendous investment from Phil Knight, who had come back in after having, you know, been alienated by the University of Oregon and some administration there. And Bellotti was the guy who kind of ushered Knight back into the fold and made it fun again and brought him in the locker room, and credit to Rich Brooks as well, who sort of paved the way for Bellotti era. But the cool thing was Bellotti got out of the way when he needed to get out of the way. Chip Kelly was at Oregon and he was ready to be hired by somebody else. And the Chip Kelly thing could have happened at USC. It could have happened at UCLA. It could have happened somewhere else. But Oregon did a smart thing in getting Pat Kilkenny into that AD seat. And Kilkenny went, this guy's a visionary. We cannot lose Chip Kelly. And what did they do? They ushered Mike Bellotti into that AD role momentarily. And then he found out he didn't like doing it. And they kind of just got Bellotti, you know, ushered him into retirement more or less. And then, you know, and I think you're right to say it, Stephen. Like, I think Mike Bellotti deserves more credit than he probably gets for where Oregon is, because you don't get to Dan Lanning and where Oregon is if there's no Mario Cristobal. In fact, you don't get there if there's no Willie Taggart or Mark Helfrich. You needed Helfrich to fail.
Right.
If Helfrich had been successful, just you know, had he gone 7-5 instead of 4-8, you know, is Helfrich still the coach at Oregon? And are they Oregon?
Well, that's the thing, is Bellotti kind of took him to as far as he could, and then they took a next step with Chip Kelly. And just like with Chip Kelly, they got to as far as they could with Chip Kelly. You know, they could have won a national championship, but he decided to go to the Eagles. And now Dan Lanning has taken it to another level. And I think that's why Bellotti doesn't get enough credit, is because Chip Kelly got him to an even higher level. And now Dan Lanning is at an even higher level than Chip Kelly was at. And so I think you look at Bellotti and you're like, all right, well, you know, he never got to that level that all these other coaches are at. But he was really the one that, you know, started to scratch the surface of what this program could be with all the innovation and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And to go out and find a guy like Chip Kelly and say, yeah, let's bring him in, be the coordinator, you know, that does deserve a lot more credit than I think he gets.
Nick Saban comparing Kurt Cignetti and Dan Lanning. This is interesting. Here's Saban.
Well, first of all, having both of these guys on staff at some point in time in their career, these two guys are probably as different personality-wise, as anybody could ever be.
Yes.
I mean, it's polar opposite. But I think the point is there's more than one way to skin a cat, so you can be very different in a lot of ways and still be successful as long as you believe in the process and the faith that you have and, you know, your principles and values in terms of, you know, Kirk Cignetti has always been an offensive guy, very serious, about learning football and trying to be the best at it, but not always. His personality has grown, in terms of his identity. And Dan Lanning has always been a positive, upbeat, defensive guy, but full of energy, enthusiasm, excitement, and I think it's contagious on everybody else. So these two guys are so different. But I do think Kirk Cignetti has done a really good job as a head coach. You know, these two guys' record is very similar, mm-hmm. you know, as head coaches in terms of where they've been, and probably doing it in a completely different style.
Definitely.
But both guys very successful in what they've done.
Yeah, Cignetti's 16-2 at Indiana, and this is a guy who, you know, came up, contrary to Dan Lanning, I mean, you know, he came up with, you know, a school in you know, at the IUP, Crimson Hawks, Division II, Indiana University of Pennsylvania was his first job, a Division II school. And then he goes to Elon Phoenix in the Colonial. Then he goes to James Madison and has success there, and then Indiana. I think it's very different because you know, Dan Lanning at age 38 has handed the keys to a Lamborghini and said, go drive this thing. They had no proof of performance.
Yeah, Signetti seems like he's a lot younger than he actually is. He's older than a lot of people think, you know, or would think he is. Because the way he acts and the way he talks trash, he's 64 years old. But it is interesting to hear Saban talk about that, because he was the wide receivers coach for Alabama at Saban's first initial coaching staff at Alabama. That's what Nick Saban thought of Kurt Signetti. So this is an interesting part of this game, too, is the head coaching matchup, because Dan Lanning's gotten those couple big wins that we've kind of questioned him on, and he looks a lot better in the X's and O's part, the game decision management. There's still some things, but I think Signetti is one of the best in-game coaches in all of college football. Like, him and DeBoer, to me, are just so good. Is it going to come down to maybe a coaching decision late in this game where Kurt Signetti says, you know what, I'm the PhD in this. I got the veteran leadership. I'm 64 years old. I've been around forever. Am I going to make that right choice? I think this is an underrated part of this matchup if it's a close game at the end of the ballgame.
We're going to be talking to Chris Hampton, the Oregon co-defensive coordinator and defensive backs coach, in just a couple minutes. He'll be joining us. But I think, if we're going to nitpick Dan Lanning, we would look at Dan Lanning's performance in games where talent is even or maybe Oregon's a slight underdog. And so I'm going back a few seasons to the three losses against Washington. I'm going back to the loss against, you have a team in Utah. You have a team that is at Ohio State, where he splits with Ohio State last
Georgia,
season.
Georgia, the first game.
Georgia, the very first game.
We kind of throw that one out, I guess.
Yeah, he had no shot in that game.
No shot.
That was really bad.
We all kind of forgot about that game, but that was Dan Lanning.
I remember, like, all my photographers take pictures for johnconzano.com, and I have all the photos they've taken from all these games, and there's this photo of Lanning. He's walking off the field after the Georgia game. His shirt is drenched. He looks like he just got his ass kicked, like, literally. And he's got this look in his eye. Like, it didn't quite go how he thought it might.
Like, maybe, did I make the right choice to leave Georgia right now?
Like, maybe I just made a bad decision, you know? Like, he looked like a guy on his wedding day and nothing went right, you know? And he's walking off going, wait a minute, did I just make a horrible mistake? So, but, you know, since that game, like, I would expect Dan Lanning to be like 500 in those games. He's not. He's under 500. He lost three times to Washington. He lost a civil war to Oregon State that he shouldn't have lost. He got beat by Georgia, of course. He split with Ohio State. He has Penn State's number. But I think this is a real good test for him. Like, you know, this is a game where Dan Lanning's favored, and he's at home against a pretty good Indiana team. I don't know how good they are, but Heather Dinich on ESPN talking about her questions about Oregon.
Honestly, I'm more curious about Oregon because after what we've seen happen to Penn State, I'm wondering how good of a win that was, to be honest. Mm. And of course, you know, you've got two fantastic quarterbacks in Dante Moore and Indiana's Fernando Mendoza. Both of them will have a chance to make a statement in terms of the Heisman race. But the reality is that this, you know, the loser of this game isn't out of the college football playoff. But when we talk about games like this, we're talking about the Big Ten conference standings, which are very critical because the five highest ranked conference champs get a lock in a spot in the college football playoff. We're also talking about seeding. Remember, you don't have to be a conference champion this year to get one of the top four seeds and a first round bye. Games like this can impact that as far as the head-to-head results.
It's why the Big Ten Conference has to be sitting back right now going, hey, best case scenario is probably Indiana narrowly beating Oregon at Oregon. And or if Oregon wins the game, it's very close, so that, you know, the Big Ten would love to get four teams in the playoff and collect all the money in the world. There's a lot of people out there right now banging the drum for the SEC saying, hey, the Big Ten's not that good. It's not that deep. This is the kind of game that gives you a sense of how good or how deep, because if Oregon boat races Indiana in this game, it leaves doubt, and it kind of underscores the idea. Remember, the narrative a year ago was Indiana's not good enough to be in the playoff. Why are they in the playoff? This is the kind of game from the Indiana standpoint where the Hoosiers have a lot to prove. Josh Pate talked about that.
We know what happened last year when Indiana went to Ohio State. They were built up. They got handled pretty thoroughly. We know what happened when they went to Notre Dame in the playoff. Got handled physically pretty thoroughly. Well, this is their next shot. I happen to believe this is a better Indiana team than they were last year. So this is their next shot. The travel spot, Big Ten teams traveling across the Rockies, 12-21. This country has not come that far since the Donner Party. If you really think about it, Big Ten teams are still having trouble getting across the Rockies.
I love that he's talking about the Donner Party. Are we in the 1800s again? Heavy snows in the Sierra Nevada? Somebody's going to eat somebody? Like, you know, Fernando Mendoza? Somebody, be careful. Make sure there's enough food on the plane. If you're Indiana, I guess they've already landed in Eugene. So
is that still a thing, though? You think the East Coast to West Coast travel and vice versa?
Yeah, I'm gonna ask John Wilner about it coming up in his visit in the 4 o'clock hour. He's tracking it, and what he has come away with, I think, anecdotally, is that he looks at the point spread and he looks at favorites. Right? What is the point spread should be about 45% to 55%. Right? It should fall one way or the other. That's the way it's designed. He has found that the point spreads that teams that are traveling across multiple time zones aren't covering. Their record against the spread is terrible. So you'd make a lot of money just betting against teams that are traveling across multiple time zones. You got two of them this weekend. Rutgers going to Washington tonight in this Friday night game, and Indiana going to Oregon. So you'd be, under Wilner's thing, you take the Ducks, you take the Huskies, and you parlay it. And, you got about 75-80% chance that you're going to win that. That's how it's worked out. But, you know, we'll talk about it coming up. Chris Hampton, he is the co-defensive coordinator at Oregon. He's a defensive backs coach, and he has something very interesting in common with Dan Lanning. Hampton and Lanning are both what? Steven, you remember Lanning? We talked about it. He was his senior class president in high school, so he was responsible for the class reunion. I found out Chris Hampton, who's coming up, also his senior class president in his high school, also responsible for his class reunion, also didn't know that the senior class president was responsible for his reunion. What is it about leadership in high school translating to leadership in the real world? Chris Hampton, Oregon defensive backs coach, is coming up.
To the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
It will be Oregon against Indiana. 5-0 against 5-0. ESPN College Game Day on the scene in Eugene. Big football game. It's like a time warp thing. If you'd just been coming out of a coma and somebody told you, huge game, Big Ten Conference between Indiana and Oregon, you'd be like, what? But that's what it is, and it'll be the Indiana passing attack, or will it be, against the Oregon defense. Chris Hampton coaches the defensive backs for the University of Oregon. He's also the co-defensive coordinator. He was also senior class president in his high school. Chris Hampton joining us now. I got to know first, let's start with the election. What kind of election was that?
Yeah, I was nominated by my senior class of Memphis, Tennessee, Melrose High. They voted for me. I think, if I remember correctly, they had like a vote and I was nominated.
What is it? A friendly competition? Do you remember who you were running against or, you know?
Oh, yeah. I do remember. I ran against a girl named Chrissy Hampton. We're not related. Same last name. Her name's Chrissy. Yeah, because she's still kind of upset that she didn't win. And she campaigned and I didn't.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she has not let me forget about that 20 years later.
Yeah, yes. I'll bet the Chris Hampton campaign was probably like, I'm Chris Hampton.
I put my name up there and that was it. There was no posters.
Yeah.
There was nothing like that. And she had them and I won. Yeah.
Was it important to you to win that? Or did you feel once you got nominated that, why was that important to you?
No, it kind of was, I took pride in it. I remember one of the deals was that we wanted a senior trip. Because the classes before us didn't take a senior trip.
Yeah.
And so that was one of our class goals, was if we could have a senior trip, we had to have good behavior and somebody had to plan it. And so we took a senior trip to Orlando, Florida. But it was something I took, and then I had to do the class reunion 10 years later.
Oh, wow.
So So that was a lot of work.
Yeah.
10 years later that I didn't know would come up. But yeah,
you probably didn't count on that. You were signing up to be in charge of the reunion.
Correct.
When you went to South Carolina, you pursued a degree in criminal justice. What were you thinking?
All right. So I started off political science, and I was thinking I wanted to go to law school. Mm. And after about a year in school, I realized I don't think I want to do that. I want to coach. Mm. And honestly, I had took some classes in criminal justice, and I liked it, and I wouldn't lose my hours. So I just went criminal justice and realized that, hey, you can coach with any degree.
Yeah.
So that's why I really ended up going criminal justice. I started out political science, had some criminology classes I had took, and I wouldn't lose them, so I just went with it.
There's some human behavior in coaching. There's human behavior in criminal science. You know, it's you're understanding people, aren't you?
Yes, definitely. It's a lot of carryover. You know, how the human mind works. You know, can you get guys to perform at a certain level? A little bit of can you psych them out? You know, a little bit of psychology in it. You know, a lot of psychology in it, honestly, in coaching. You know, when they're not doing well, how can you get them to perform well? How can you motivate guys? How can you get them over the hump? You know, a lot of obstacles they go through in life, and you know, get them to where they want to go to.
You go back to your college time. You know, you started 2 years as a safety at South Carolina. What did you get? Playing at that time for the coaching staff you were playing for.
You know, I got some tough love, I think, at times. You know, back then, you know, coaches were, you know, probably a little bit harder than they are now. You know, there wasn't any portal. You didn't have to worry about anything like that. But the coaching was hard. But I think I learned some really valuable lessons, you know, about being accountable, you know, being a good teammate, you know, doing things right. And there's a lot of things in football, you know, schematically that I learned in that still carries over today.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You come in, Lou Holtz is the coach, right? And then by the time you leave,
correct,
it's Steve Spurrier. So you get,
correct,
like, these are big personalities.
Yes, yes, and complete different too as well. But yeah, with two legendary coaches, you know, Holtz was more of, I think guys feared him. Mm-hmm. You know, the staff at times, it seemed like they feared him. You know, he was hard-nosed, gritty, tough. We're going to be the toughest team, you know, to take the field each and every week. Spurrier was not that way.
Yeah.
He was more of a charismatic personality, but he was disciplined in a different way that you had to do things right. Or, you know, he would take your playing time, or he would, you know, punish you in another way. So it was, you know, it was just black and white, what you had to do with him, but it wasn't as much fear factor, if that makes sense.
We're talking to Chris Hampton, co-defensive coordinator at Oregon and in charge of the secondary. That back end, you guys lost a lot last year, and I know everybody was looking and going, hey, how's that going to be on the back end of the defense? How have you felt about the early part of the season with these guys?
You know, so far, I think we performed, you know, pretty solid. You know, we've got to do it again this week. You know, I think this is going to be our toughest challenge to date going against Indiana. But, yeah, we lost a lot of guys last year. We've had a lot of young guys step up. You know, you look at Aaron Flowers, Kingston Lopa, Peyton Willard, you know, Brandon Finney, Ify Obidegwu, a lot of guys, some new guys that came in as true freshmen, some guys that redshirted last year or didn't play as much, didn't step up. And then we've had a couple of valuable transfers, you know, with Dylan, Jaden Kennedy, and Theron Johnson. Gave us some great minutes and a lot of production.
Chris, when you're recruiting or evaluating a young DB kid coming out of high school, obviously you look at the athletic part, but what are you looking for between the ears? What's the mentality that you like to see?
Yeah, you want to see a guy that loves football. If he's infatuated with the process, which is, you know, sometimes you have to dig deep to find that, you know, these days, you know, that to make sure this guy's going to love the grind, he's going to embrace it, that he wants to play football for the reasons that you want to play football, that he loves to compete, he loves the competition, he wants to win. So that's what you're really looking for between the ears, a guy that's motivated intrinsically, and he wants to be great.
You were down at South Carolina, Tulane, Duke, McNeese State, Central Arkansas. Had you ever been to Eugene, the Pacific Northwest?
No.
What did you think of that? It must have been like going to the moon.
Yeah, it was completely different. You know, I'd never lived on the West Coast in my life. You know, I never really thought it would happen, you know, and, you know, out of nowhere, I kind of got a call from Coach Lanning. We had a couple conversations, and I was off to Oregon. I remember I told my mom I was going here, and she was like, "Where is that at?" It's by Canada.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love that. I've had people who live in like the western part of the United States. They go, "What time zone is it in?" I'm like, "It's in the same time zone as California." What are you talking about? Time zone. What was different, or maybe maybe was it just as you expected it, or when you got out to Eugene, when you looked around, you were, you know, what surprised you?
The hospitality. I think that was a little bit different. That there was still great people that lived out here, and how hospitable everyone has been. Since I've been living out here, it's been great.
I mean, you were class president. Dan Lanning was class president. I mean, do we have any other class presidents on the coaching staff? I mean, this can't be accidental. It's a leadership thing.
I don't know. You know, it's leadership, right? You're a coach, you're a leader. So, you know, it kind of happened naturally, I guess.
Chris Hampton with us. All right. Indiana, you look at their offense. They obviously got a QB that everybody's talking about. But what are they doing schematically to put pressure on defenses?
A lot of RPOs, you know, run pass options. They do a great job of running the football. If I'm not mistaken, I think they lead the Big Ten in rushing right now. So that's one of the things that they do. I know Mendoza's playing at a high level, but they're very efficient. You know, they're going to run the football, you know, hit you with some RPOs, hit you with a play action pass. But you have to be able to stop the run against these guys. I think first and foremost, it's not allowed them to establish a running game if you want to be successful.
Yeah, I'm looking at the tape of that Illinois game. They rushed for, you know, 300 yards or so, and commanded the game, and it just makes everything so easy when you can do that. All right, the emotion of the Penn State game, what did that feel like for you being part of that in, you know, the locker room afterwards, the plane ride home? I want to look back just a little bit before we look forward, but you know, what was that like for you?
You know, it was great to see the guys have the success, you know, of all the work we put in, you know, leading them to that game, you know, some of the stuff that we did in the offseason of self-scout, some things that hurt us from the last time we played them. You know, we had did a lot of, you know, advanced prep on those guys, and that was just fantastic to see the guys win in that type of environment. That was a great environment, you know, whiteout. We came out victorious, and so I was really just happy to see the players have the success that they did and come away with a victory.
Yeah, in the game-ending play, the interception to end it, as that play is unfolding, are you watching it unfold, or what's going through your mind as that route, the motion, everything is unfolding, and you watch your guy get in position and make a play?
Yeah, you know, we talked about it on the sidelines. Kind of crazy that we thought, hey, be alert for that play. And I know Dylan said that, you know, hey, be alert for this route. They had shown it on film. It was one of their staple plays, basically, and they ran it, you know, and he made a great play on it, you know, and intercepted it. But we had talked about it previously, didn't know exactly how they would build the play. You know, mm-hmm. It's the same play, but a different motion, you know, a different dress up from time to time. That's what happens. And so as you saw it unfolding, like, oh, there it goes, and bam, he intercepted it.
That's got to be a good feeling as a coach because, you know.
Oh, great feeling. Yeah. Great feeling. You know, a lot of times you know, on the sideline, you kind of see the play happen. Like, oh, the man, he missed it, you know, but he was waiting on it. And so he executed perfectly and made a big-time play.
What do you get being on the sideline that you don't get if you're up in the box?
Just the interaction with the players. You're able to look them in the eyes, see their body language, you know, see who's up, who's down. Just kind of a little bit of that, you know, and now you have the iPad on the sideline, so you can watch the previous plays. I think they started that last season, so you can recap the game with the guys in real time.
You didn't have that with Lou Holtz and Steve Spurrier, did you?
No, you did not. You didn't have that till you went back in the film room and got in trouble.
Yeah, like it would be like a day later, and you know, you'd be going, here's how I saw it, and then you look at the tape and you go, oh wait, yeah. You're right. You know, they were outside the hash, or, you know, oh no, I wasn't quite in the right spot. And so the advantage of having that in real time is, I guess it's better for players. Is it like, how does that affect you as a coach on the sideline? Because you have to be ready to
look on it
right now, correct right now.
Immediately. Yeah. So you can give immediate feedback. You get the iPad, you look at it, you can tag plays, like save plays that you want to come back to at halftime or whatever. And, you could talk about, you know, another call versus that play, like how we're going to defend this play. If we're in this defense compared to the defense that we're currently running. So you're able to make adjustments quickly, based off that iPad.
All right. I want to have you look a little bit back in your career. You were at Tulane. You know, you spent time there and obviously helped Tulane become, you know, they're a power in the American. And I'm trying to figure out how this all fits together in the world of college football. You're at the top of it right now at Oregon. You guys are playing for, you know, a playoff berth and a championship. But schools in that group of five, group of six, you know, can you speak to a little bit of the mentality difference when you go from like a Tulane to an Oregon? And is it just resources? I mean, you still had great players there. You had guys like, you know, Perry Nickerson there at Tulane. You had great players. But what's the difference, really?
Yeah, I think it's the resources, right? And it's the guys that you can recruit out of high school. You know, there's a lot of guys on this team. If I was at Tulane, when I went in their school, they wouldn't talk to me. You know, but when you go in and you have the Oregon brand, you got Alton Stadium, you know, everything that they know about the University of Oregon, a traditional powerhouse, you're able to just recruit a little bit better. You're able to get a better athlete out of high school. Whereas at Tulane, sometimes you have to just uncover the hidden gem, you know, and do a little bit of development. It may be a guy that's playing quarterback, and you're going to have to, you know, project that he can be a DB in college. Or it may be a guy that's playing tight end, and you say, okay, he's going to grow into an offensive tackle. You know, so that's just really, I think, the biggest difference is the projection, whereas here we can go look at the best high school players in the country and say, okay, I want to get him. And you have a realistic chance of getting him because of the power of the L.
Man, you've got, you know, you arrive on campus, everybody's buzzing. Guy from Oregon's here. You know, he's here
correct,
to work out.
Correct,
know,
it's different. When you walk into school with Oregon on your chest, all the kids want to shake your hand. Yep.
All right, Chris Hampton, before I let you go, do you watch the CSI crime shows? Is the criminal element still in you? Are you trying to figure
it
out?
I have never seen it. No,
you don't watch it. So you're not into it. No. Is there a career in law enforcement for you after football, or is it just football all the way?
No. It's just football. Hopefully football, as long as I can do it. I think my law enforcement days are over at the University of South Carolina.
There you go. All right, Chris Hampton, good to get to know you a little bit. Thanks for making time. Appreciate you, man.
Thanks, John.
All right. Take care. All right. There he goes. Chris Hampton. He is co-defensive coordinator, defensive backs coach at the University of Oregon. I love that little thing of, you know, hey, guys that didn't want to talk with me when I was there recruiting on behalf of Tulane. Now, you know, you got different guys who are like, hey, Oregon's here. I'll talk to you. Good stuff, Chris Hampton. They'll be up against an Indiana offense that really everybody talks about the quarterback. But when Indiana has been at its best this season, it's because the Hoosiers run the football. Leave it here. You got the bald-faced truth statewide on the BFT Radio Network.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Mariners, Tigers, winner take all game five tonight right here on 750 The Game. We're going to lead you right into that. I'm also going to tell you in this segment what's on tap this weekend. Before I get to that, though, how about Cam Scataboo? Cam Scataboo went wild. Had a great game. You're not surprised, Steven. I saw you on Twitter tweeting about Cam.
No, it's like that band you knew about before nobody else did. That's what it feels like. Now the NFL is all caught on to Scataboo. Like, we've been watching that guy for 2 years at Arizona State just be an animal, especially that last season as a senior. Like, he was an animal every single time he ran the ball. He tried to just run people's heads off, and he's doing the same exact thing in the NFL, and it's working. It's really cool to see because you can tell that guy just loves football, man, and he's super successful. Now him and Jackson Dart are the future of the Giants, and they got a somewhat bright future, I guess, after they beat the Eagles.
Yeah, and they were, I think the money line yesterday prior to the game was like
huge.
3-1.
Yeah, maybe more. Know?
Yeah, so, but people having trouble tackling that guy. Afterwards, he says he's got a couple extra days rest, 98 yards and 3 touchdowns against the Eagles. Here's Cam.
I'll be playing video games, taking care of my body. You know, there's not a thing that can get me out of the zone of football right now. Just continuing to work and make sure that, you know, these guys are staying focused and, like I said, bringing the energy to make sure that these guys know I'm locked in and we're all locked in together.
He gives you an idea of how much Arizona State's lost. Like, he was... I mean, he was the offense at Arizona State, and Kenny Dillingham had him. And here's a guy, you know, you talk about the NFL or the, you know, college scouts missing on Cam Ward. You know, Cam Ward has no scholarships offers, goes to Incarnate Word, then Washington State, then Miami, then he's the number one pick in the draft. Cam Scataboo was at Sacramento State, Steven. He was at Sac State before he was at Arizona State. There are players out there who can play, and they find their way. I tell people they'll find you. They eventually found Cam Scataboo.
Yeah, that's the thing is he dropped in the draft because of how slow he ran and that kind of stuff like that. But you can tell this guy is going to be good no matter what. And the question would be, is his body going to wear, is it going to stand up for the test of time with the way that he runs and tries to just annihilate everybody in his path?
He's looking for contact.
Yeah, like that's the one fear you have is like, yes, he's a tough dude. He's a big guy. But like, does that work in the NFL? I don't know.
Well, I think John Riggins made it work. I think we've seen Larry Zonka made it work. Cam Scataboo running that way. It brings us to what's on tap this weekend. I'll blend some NFL in with some college football, in with some potential baseball. Let's do it.
Now, it's time for What's on Tap.
Brought to you by the Independent Sports Bar downtown and the Satellite Tavern.
Home of North Portland's best wings and pizza.
Well, tonight it's Mariners-Tigers right here on 750 The Game, also on Fox. First pitch, 5:08. Fresno State playing at Colorado State at 6 o'clock tonight on CBS Sports Network. Rutgers-Washington tonight also at 6 on FS1. We got a lot going on. Early games, UCLA-Michigan State, 9 a.m. Saturday morning on the Big Ten Network. Stanford's at SMU at 9 a.m. on the CW. Washington State going into hostile territory in SEC country. They'll play at 5-0 Mississippi, 9:45 Saturday on the SEC Network. Indiana's at Oregon at 12:30 on CBS. Rick Neuheisel on the call, 5-0 against 5-0. Wake Forest, 3-2 Wake Forest at 0-6 Oregon State, 12:30 Saturday on the CW. Other games on Saturday, Michigan's at USC at 4:30 on NBC, BYU Arizona at 5 o'clock on ESPN2. Also, Arizona State, maybe without Sam Levitt, he is listed as doubtful, at Utah, 7:15 on ESPN. Potential American League Championship Series Game 1 for the Mariners and Blue Jays on Sunday. Game 1 would be Sunday, Game 2 would be Monday if the Mariners advanced, or otherwise it's the Tigers sitting in their place. Certainly a bunch of NFL games this weekend that are taking center stage for people who are into it. You've got certainly Sunday morning Rams-Ravens in a big game on Fox at 10 a.m. Cowboys-Panthers also at 10 a.m. Later at 10 a.m. also Seattle going to Jacksonville, 4-1 Jacksonville. I did not have them at 4-1 to start the season. The Niners at 1:25 on CBS visiting Tampa Bay. Brock Purdy out again. Also, Mac Jones questionable against the Buccaneers. What will the Niners do? All of that, of course, leading us into Sunday night football. It'll be the Lions and the 2-3 Kansas City Chiefs. And then Monday night, it's Buffalo going to Atlanta. On Chicago, also going to Washington on Monday. Two games, doubleheader on Monday. Possible ALCS game 2 on Monday. Steven, if you're a sports fan, this is it. You're in your sweet spot.
It's a big one. And even tonight, like you said, you got Mariners-Tigers, but it's a sneaky college football game besides Rutgers-Washington. South Florida's at North Texas. Those are two of the favorites to get into the college football playoff out of the group of five. South Florida, they, of course, beat Boise, and they won at Florida. If they lose to North Texas, who dominated Washington State, I think North Texas has a real argument to say, look, we're the best team in the American. They're 5-0 right now, so that's actually a sneaky good game out in the American. And then, yeah, you talk about Saturday, all the good games, Alabama at Missouri. Like, is Missouri actually real? They've played nobody, but they're undefeated taking on Alabama. The UCLA-Michigan State game is very intriguing to me. We talked about the travel. Does UCLA keep up that offense that they had against Penn State, or do they kind of just celebrate because they got the Penn State win and Jonathan Smith needs a victory? So lots of good sports going on this weekend.
Well I think if you are a sports fan, you are looking at this weekend's games and you're going, okay, tonight you got Mariners-Tigers, you got to watch that, but then you keep an eye on the college football games. Tomorrow's easy. Tomorrow is about Oregon and Oregon State at 12:30. They're both at 12:30. If you're a Duck fan, big game against Indiana, but you have earned a little bit of a wide berth on this one. Oregon doesn't have to win this game tomorrow at 12:30. And then the Beavers are in an absolute, can they win? Will they win? Do you trust them to win against Wake Forest?
Am I crazy? As the week's gone on, John, I kind of like the Beavs. Like, the more I think about it, the more I think, you know what, this is the week. This is the week the Beavs win.
I said that against Houston. I said it against Appalachian State. I think that the Beavers, like, I picked them with the points against Wake, partly because it falls into the category of a team traveling across multiple time zones.
Right, that's a, yeah.
You know, and here's the other thing if you're Wake Forest, okay? Put yourself in the mindset of the Wake Forest players. They don't know anything about Oregon State. Like, you know, the quarterback does because he was a backup at Oregon. But the rest of that Wake Forest team is going, why are we going to Corvallis in the middle of our season?
To face an 0-6 team?
Facing an 0-6 team in a non-conference game that doesn't count in a season that is a rebuild. There is a little chance here that I think Wake Forest, and they got a bigger game next week, big conference game next week. I think there's a shot here that this is a trap game for Wake and Jake Dickert. And I don't think, like, the crowd necessarily is going to be a big crowd. And I actually think that it plays to Oregon State's favor. Like, if you're coming in at a 12:30 kickoff and the stadium's half empty and it's an 0-6 opponent, it's a long travel thing. You know, they're flying in and they're bussing to Corvallis. I kind of think Oregon State might catch them. But Oregon State's got to play, and I don't trust Oregon State. So I'm in this position with the Beavers where I'm like, don't really believe in him. But I will, you know, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. All right, the BFT jury is coming up. I hope you're here for it. Michael Llewellyn, Craig Birnbach, we're going to talk a little bit about what Rob Mullins said on the show yesterday, but we're going to talk about heartbreak and triumph as a sports fan. Leave it here.
BFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
They would love a base hit into the gap, and they could win it with junior speed to stretch. And the 0-1 pitch on the way to Edgar Martinez. Swung on the line down the left field line for a base hit. Here comes Joy. Here is Junior to third base. They're going to wave him in. The throw to the plate will be late. The Mariners are going to play for the American League Championship. I don't believe it. It just continues. My, oh, my. Edgar Martinez with a double. Ripped down the left field line, and they are going crazy at the Kingdom.
Well, it won't be the Kingdom, but it's going to be Seattle nonetheless. Mariners-Tigers tonight. Game 5, winner-take-all, ALDS winner goes to Toronto for Game 1 of the American League Championship Series on Sunday. Game 1 on Sunday, Game 2 on Monday. Then 3 games back in Seattle, presumably. We shall see. The Mariners on the cusp of something big. Our BFT jury here to talk about it. Mariners a game away from the American League Championship Series. I want to talk to our jurors about a team that they rooted for that broke through, because the Mariners are looking for a breakthrough. What did it mean? How much heartache went into that? How much joy at the end of it? Was there joy? Also, the Big Ten is closing in on a private equity deal. How does this play in the minds of our jurors? College athletics letting the wolf into the hen house? Or is it finally acting like a real big-dollar business? We'll talk about it. Michael Llewellyn, Craig Birnbach, along with others, 503-417-7575, you want to be one of the others. Those are the jurors. Those are the subjects. Let's do it, Stephen.
Spanning the city in search of sports fans willing to explore the constant variety of sport and opinion. These sports freaks are prepared to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the bald-faced truth.
He's asking you if you swear to tell the truth.
This isn't 12 angry men stuck in a jury room. It's Boulder.
Kindly address this court as your honor.
Welcome, the Bald-Faced Truth Jury.
Well, the jurors are in the deliberation room. Craig Birnbach, longtime sports anchor, sports reporter. You can check him out on Friday Night Flights, covering high school football this great Friday night. Michael Llewellyn, longtime Blazers, Nike executive, University of Portland executive, along with Steven, who is going to play on the BFT jury today. John Strong, voice of American soccer, is at OMSI with the kids. Just keeping it real. Craig Birnbach joining us now. Craig, let's talk about those teams. The Mariners are right on the cusp of a breakthrough or major heartache. Did you have a team you rooted for that broke through or maybe gave you some heartache?
Well, John, I root for the Yankees. And you just played that clip of the day, but I'm still recovering. So, not cool. Not cool. I might go to OMSI right now. That's right. Join Josh Swamp.
I love it.
What the heck? I did not need to hear that. Don Mattingly never making the playoffs, never winning a World Series, even though now he's a Blue Jays coach and he might win one. But those, you know. So with that, yes, I grew up a New York sports fan. I'm still a New York sports fan. People think it's great. But when I was a kid, they sucked at everything. The Knicks sucked. Mm. The Yankees sucked. The Giants sucked. The Rangers sucked. So the one team that finally didn't suck was the 85-86 Giants when they won the Super Bowl. I was still a kid when that happened. It's really the only championship I got to celebrate as a kid. And when I started watching the Giants, I mean, they were so awful. I mean, I remember there were two 13-1 the first when they got, Lawrence Taylor at first. Just awful. So that to win that Super Bowl, and I went and watched that with friends at Dave Isley's house, and when they won, we just all ran outside, and the whole, area, then I was living in New Jersey, but which is where the Giants play, by the way, and the Jets, the only New York football team's actually Buffalo, but that's a different story. I just remember we ran, it was icy, and there was snow, and I fell, and I did one of those things where when you're a kid and you put your hands out, and you get the gravel skids, where you get little pebbles in your hand because you fell so hard. And I didn't care because the Giants won the Super Bowl, and I knew what, winning a championship was like, and it was awesome. And it felt like everyone I knew was a Giants fan. There's some Jet fans sprinkled in, but that's their fault. So that was awesome after so much just losing as a sports fan as a kid.
Yeah, because people normally would associate being a Yankee fan with all of this success, but you're right, 27 world championships, nothing from 1979 to 1995, which is the sweet spot of your childhood. This is not like you were a kid in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s who got to see world championships every year. Did it make it sweeter because you had seen so much losing?
Yeah, I mean, when you look back at it, I had a root for Mel Hall. I'd be like, they were terrible. That's why Don Mattingly was such a big deal, because he was the first Yankee in a long time. 81, I was young, but they went, and it was the strike year, and it was the split, and they lost to the Dodgers, and there was Dave Winfield on that team. So there wasn't like that was awful, but they were some really bad teams, and the Giants really bad. So that's why the Giants were the first team I rooted for that won. I mean, there's a reason why Patrick Ewing was the Knicks got the number one overall pick. Yes, it was a lottery, but they sucked for a long time too. So in my teams didn't get good. Like the Yankees, obviously 96, until, 2009. Now we've had a drought. We won a lot and it was awesome. And that was fantastic. But, I also had to grow up in a town where the Mets were good and won a title. And I still can't stand Pat Walker, who was a Met fan and sat with me at lunch in like sixth grade bragging. I because it sucked because you had Met fans there that were around to rub it in. I always say, John, this is the thing. In 1986, I was a young kid, and I did not understand the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry enough yet. And this is why. Because I remember rooting for the Red Sox to beat the Mets. Because I didn't know any Red Sox fans yet, but I knew Mets fans, and they sat with me at lunch, and I don't want to hear it. So now I need a time machine to go back in time and kick my own butt for doing that, because that's how, as a Yankee fan.
You didn't know the rules.
No, I didn't. I just knew I can't stand these Mets fans. They're right in front of me.
Craig Burnback, we're going to put him on hold. Michael Llewellyn joining us now. Llewellyn, do you relate to that? Did you root for a team that either gave you a thrill of victory or an agony of defeat or maybe both?
John, I'm sitting here almost face down, man. Can Burnback carry a grudge or can he carry a grudge?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. You know, growing up in Northeast Arkansas, we were kind of right down that St. Louis Cardinal chute on KMOX radio, one of those flamethrower AM stations. And so I grew up listening to Jack Buck call Cardinal baseball, and the Cardinals were always close to my heart. And many, 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 many years later, when I was, as you know, I was vice president of Fox Sports Network at a time in my career, and I got a chance to meet Joe Buck and got a chance to tell Joe about me as a little kid in Arkansas with a little transistor radio listening to his dad call Cardinal baseball. And later in my career, when I worked for Southwestern Bell Corporation, I actually lived in St. Louis for 5 years and got a chance to go to a bunch of Cardinal games. But my heartbreakers of heartbreakers, you know, are still my beloved Dallas Cowboys. And Super Bowl V, when Jim O'Brien kicked that field goal for the Baltimore Colts, I was a little kid. I just went outside and hid behind the pecan tree in our backyard and just cried my eyes out over losing that Super Bowl. Years later, they obviously beat the Dolphins and won some Super Bowls. And during my Nike career, John, I got a chance to meet Roger Staubach. I got a chance to spend the night in Roger Staubach's house and had dinner with Charlie Waters, who's an old Cowboys safety from back in the day. So the Cowboys have a special place in my heart. I've moved around a lot in my career, as you know, and I love rooting for the local teams in the towns that I'm in. You know, I worked for the Blazers for 7 years. Used to hate the Blazers back when Bill Walton and the guys beat my 76ers for their only championship in 77. But love the Cowboys, love the St. Louis Cardinals, and even met Bob Gibson in St. Louis, and that's one of the rare times that I really fanboyed out, was standing there with the great Bob Gibson in front of me. And my wife at the time thought I'd had a stroke because I couldn't speak.
Yeah.
Where
was it? What was the setting for that when you met Gibson?
Southwestern Bell had just transferred me to St. Louis to work for them in PR. This was before my sports days and the old corporate days. And the temporary housing that I was in a high-rise in downtown St. Louis, about a five-minute walk to Busch Stadium called the Mansion House. And we got on the elevator, and there's Bob Gibson, because he lived in the Mansion House. He was still part of the Cardinals broadcast team back in those days, and a Cardinal ambassador, and standing there in the elevator, petrified that I'm standing there near one of my childhood heroes. So,
Great.
Like I said, my wife at the time laughed out loud when we got off the elevator, because she said I was so frozen stiff, she thought I'd had a stroke.
I love it. Michael Llewellyn with that. We'll come back to our jurors. Stephen, I want to go to you. I have a question for you, Stephen. When the Blazers won the world championship in 1977, how old were you?
I was negative 10. Was not born yet. But I have heard so many stories from that generation of like just how what it was like. And that's like my dream is now to have that happen, especially with my kids around. And my oldest is a big Blazer fan now. Like, he loves the team. We were watching the preseason game the other night. Like, he loves it. It's funny because we're talking about the fandom. Like, I was just talking to my son today because I was playing old. You know, remember back in the day when they made like Blazer theme songs, and you know, like Bust a Bucket, Rip City, yes. Rhapsody. I was playing those songs for him today because I wanted to have, you know, teach him the history. And I was talking about when Can I Get a Headband came out, because all the Blazers were in headbands. And then I, you know, they've lost the Lakers in game 7 up, 15 as start the fourth quarter. Brian Shaw hits a bunch of threes. Like, I'll never forget that. And that's like my memory of like, man, I will never get that out of my head, and that feeling when I see Brian Shaw or I see Kobe throw up the alley-oop to Shaq. And like, you just got to teach them, you know, when your teams stink, you got to teach your kids like the history of how bad it's been. That way it'll get better when they actually win games. But it's like that. Those are the type of things that I remember, man. And I'll never forget it. Like, I'll never forget those moments because I was like 13, 14 when that happened. And, you know, it's just it's something in my memory that'll never go away, watching Shaq with that dunk and Brian Shaw hit threes and Rashid choked down the end. It just wasn't good, man.
I know this. Dwight Clark and Joe Montana gave me a very similar moment that Craig Birnbach had when he ran out into the streets when the New York Giants won the Super Bowl. And my San Francisco 49ers had been terrible. They were 2-14, they were 6-10, and all of a sudden, you know, they were in a Super Bowl. But it doesn't happen without the catch. And it was the NFC Championship game. It was getting by the Dallas Cowboys. It was me at age 10 watching this unfold, and seeing, you know, Joe Montana hit Dwight Clark in the back corner of the end zone with the catch and then running out the sliding doors out into the backyard of my parents' house and missing the end of the game, which was fairly dramatic because the Cowboys came back and there was a fumble. And so I will never forget that moment.
Third and three. We'll see a pickup sometime on the right side, possibly.
Montana looking, throwing in the end zone. It's a madhouse at Candlestick with 51 seconds left. Dwight Clark is 6'4". He stands about 10 feet tall in this crowd's estimation.
I love that. Vin Scully was on the call there on that broadcast as Montana hits Dwight Clark. 51 seconds left. I missed the end of that game. Pivoting the jury, Mariners fans, I hope you get a big moment tonight. Hope you get to the ALCS. But pivoting the jury a little bit, Big Ten Conference closing in on a private equity deal. How is this playing? How careful does the Big Ten need to be? Or is this letting the wolf in the hen house? Or is this the Big Ten and college sports finally acknowledging, hey, they're a big-dollar business? Craig Bernbach, where do you stand on private equity being in the Big Ten Conference's world?
John, there's no hens left in the house. It's all wolves. Like, there hasn't been hens in a while. Like, I'm not sure like where these innocent animals live that you're worried about. That's gone. They're going to make money. It's pro. I mean, I read your interview with Rob Mullins saying that it's not pro sport. It's pro sports. I mean, they're paying players. They're paying coaches. Who's not getting paid? They're not what professional. If you get paid to do something, you're a professional. So I don't know what we're holding on to when it comes to, at least at the college football and college basketball level at the upper echelon. Let me say this, and looking at it, if I were Ohio State or Michigan, and possibly even Oregon or Washington, but definitely if I were Ohio State or Michigan, I would think, I don't know if that's enough. I mean, if you know, the Portland Trailblazers are selling for $4 billion, you're getting 10% for $2 billion for 18 teams. If I'm Ohio State, I'm thinking, Ohio State football? Are we not worth more than that? And then if you mix in the other stuff, when you split it, is 10% of us not $200 million? You know, so I don't like it because, you know, and I know Michael's going to come on and he's going to really hate it. And I get why, because tradition's gone. The public university thing, that's something, you know, and I'm not sure how that pans out. We've got senators saying you can't sell your parts of your university to a for-profit and then still be a not-for-profit and tax-exempt stuff. But I'm not smart enough to understand all that. I just know that I don't know if I'd want to be first here. If I were at the SEC, I'd be happy to see what the Big Ten does first.
Yeah.
And then go out.
Fair point. Craig Bernbach, thank you for your service on the jury. Michael Llewellyn, where are you on Big Ten and private equity?
John, for the record, I'm still angry at Dwight Clark because Everson Walls was covering him. Yeah. Everson Walls should have seen that football. I screamed at the television at a volume that frightened my parents when I saw that catch. You know what? This is the thing that if there ever was something that has greased the skids for politicians to jump right smack dab in the middle of intercollegiate athletics, this is it. Because you've already got a Republican representative there in the state of Washington, Michael Baumgartner. He has already introduced the Protect College Sports from Private Equity and Foreign Influence Act to keep private equity and hedge funds and foreign sovereign funds, like what the Saudi Arabians have done with professional golf and the LIV Tour, from infiltrating college football and intercollegiate athletics. This is going to be trouble. And this is something that's going to wind up before it ever goes through. And they may go through. The Big Ten may vote for it and think they're going to get away with it. But this is one of those things that winds up on the floor of Congress. And I think it's going to be a mess. And it really does. It really is the advent of the disillusion. If the NCAA thought it had a fight on its hands before, in keeping an eye on college athletics, this changes everything, because this is not their money. This is money coming from outside sources that the NCAA can't block, and I think we're facing not only, you know, antitrust issues, but the notion of colleges and universities losing their tax-exempt status. This is bad.
Michael Llewellyn, thank you for your service on the jury. I think it's super dicey, and I tried to get Rob Mullins on the record about it yesterday, and he kind of danced around it. He tap danced around it, and he ultimately said, "Yeah, you've got to be really diligent, and you've got to really figure out what's going on." But I think what's going to happen is, I think Llewellyn's right. I think Birnbach's right too, that there aren't any more hens in the hen house. It's just foxes. And which fox is the most dangerous now? Oh, is it Fox? Literally TV? That could be it. Like it, but I think what's going to happen is the Big Ten's going to probably vote for this. They're nearing a vote. They're probably going to vote to approve it. And then you're going to get pushback from the public schools that go, wait a minute. Like, how can we sell off part of the operation? The truth is, these athletic departments have been operating with self-sufficiency for some time. And I think they're going to try to lean into that idea. But it's certainly rife with complexity. I don't like it. I don't like letting private equity into the room. I also recognize that these academic institutions aren't used to operating like businesses. You know, it's like, you know, they're franchises now. And, you know, it's no different than Dutch Bros when they went with an IPO. Like the Big Ten, it's got 18 different locations. Which franchise do you like the most? Rutgers is playing at Washington. Indiana's playing at Oregon. Coming up, we'll talk about all of the college football of the weekend, particularly the Pacific Northwest schools. John Wilner's going to join us, San Jose Mercury News. He's going to talk about Oregon playing against Indiana. We're going to talk about tonight's Rutgers-Washington game. Wilner's on the scene in Seattle for that one. He's coming down to the other game. We'll talk about Oregon State's must-win situation, Washington State going on the road to Mississippi. We'll touch on the must-see games of the weekend and more. Steven, you fired up about the Ducks, Hoosiers. Who do you got? Who you got in the game?
I got the Ducks winning, but I got the Hoosiers covering. I think it's going to be a close game, one-score game. I wouldn't be surprised if Mendoza gets the win, but I'll take the Ducks.
I have the Ducks by 10. The rest of my picks are at johnconzano.com for anybody who wants to check them out. Plus, we'll lead you right into the Mariners coming up top of the hour. Leave it here. John Wilner, San Jose Mercury News is next. You got the bald-faced truth statewide on the BFT Radio Network.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, he's coming to the Pacific Northwest, a tour of the Pacific Northwest. John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News will be in Seattle tonight to see the Huskies play Rutgers. He's heading down the I-5 all the way to Eugene to see Oregon, Indiana tomorrow at Autzen Stadium. I'm making the drive with him, and he's joining us now. You do this every year. You try to pick kind of a swing where you do a Friday, Saturday. Why did you pick this one?
Yeah, no, it helps to get two games for the price of one. I usually try to do it when one of the Pacific Northwest schools has got a Friday night game. Last year, I got the Oregon-Michigan State game in, drove to Seattle, and got Huskies against Michigan. So this year, I get the Huskies and Rutgers tonight. And then, you know, I had hoped to get both the Oregon-Indiana and the Oregon State-Wake Forest games in, but it turns out that they're at the same time.
Yeah.
Which I did not expect. I kind of thought the Oregon game would be at 4:30, but the Big Ten and network partners put it at 12:30, right up against the Beavers.
I found that a couple of times this year that Oregon and Oregon State had played that at the same time, and it didn't used to happen when the Pac-12 was a thing, right? The Pac-12 would be more mindful of that, but when you've got, you know, an independent schedule TV partner and you've got the Big Ten as the other TV partner, you get sort of, you know, everybody thinking for themselves. You're going to do a three banger. Now it's a twofer. Let's start with tonight's game with Rutgers in Seattle to play Washington. Pretty good Rutgers offense, but Washington defense that has been very good.
It has. And Rutgers gave up 38 points at home to Iowa. I mean, nobody's going to confuse Iowa with a Mike Leach offense, right? And they still managed 38 points against Rutgers. I do think the Scarlet Knights, they benefit. They have had 2 weeks to get ready for this long trip. That should help them. But I don't know how they're going to keep up and keep the Huskies out of the end zone. I think Washington's going to kind of score at will.
Yeah, it feels that way. Yeah, I noticed last week, Damon Williams Jr., I think he had 14 or 15 carries. Is that load getting a little too heavy for you in early games? I know you want to do that in games you know you need to win, but do you risk him running the football, running around out there a little too much if you're Jed Fish?
Probably it's something you need to be mindful of. He's not exactly 6'4", 230, but they also got to bank as many wins as they can by any means necessary to a certain degree. And I think that, you know, they're just generally more difficult to stop. If he feels like he can run when the opportunity presents itself and he doesn't feel confined to the pocket, they're just that, you know, a multidimensional offense at that point, because you've got Williams with his arm, Williams with his legs, Jonah Coleman with his legs, and Denzel Boston out catching passes.
Yeah, the Big Ten giving Rutgers the extra time off, traveling across multiple time zones. These were the types of games that you used to jump on in the Pac-12 when you saw somebody playing on a Thursday or a Friday and they had to travel a bit. Any concerns about the travel, or does that extra time off just make it easier for Rutgers to adjust?
I think it might help a little, but to me, the travel's a real thing. I've been tracking it for a year and a half now, and teams that travel multiple time zones for Big Ten conference games are 11-23-1 against the spread, right? And you figure with the spread, right, anything in that 45% to 55% is generally normal, right? The spread's geared to make everything 50-50. And yet the teams that have had to travel long distances in the Big Ten are only covering 32% of the time.
Wow.
That tells you that there's something to it, right?
Wake Forest, Oregon State, Saturday. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about Washington State and Mississippi. But I want to go to the other game you're at. It'll be this big matchup with Oregon and Indiana. Tomorrow, games on CBS at 12:30. Ducks coming off a bye. What do you make of the Penn State loss to UCLA, and how does that factor into how you view Oregon now a couple weeks later?
Yeah, I think you have to reassess Oregon's win in Happy Valley a little bit, right? Because if Penn State were really good, there's no way they would lose to UCLA. So it's still a great win for Oregon. But maybe it's not that good a win. And so is Oregon really elite, or are they just really good? I think we'll find out a lot against Indiana, because Indiana's pretty good. So I don't know that the Hoosiers can stay with them the whole time, but I think it's going to tell us a lot about both teams because of that Penn State-UCLA game. That was one of those games that kind of makes you rethink all your presumptions about a lot of things.
The Hoosiers and Ducks, ideally the Big Ten would like four teams in the playoff. They'd like to see both those teams get in. What's the best case scenario for the Big Ten, in trying to get four teams in the playoff?
I actually think the best case scenario for the Big Ten would be for Indiana to win a close game at Autzen Stadium. And here's why. Because Oregon's got an easier path down the stretch. They don't play Michigan or Ohio State, and they get the Huskies at home, and they get USC at home. The Huskies on the road, USC at home, right? I think Oregon has fewer potholes left than Indiana does. So if you're the Big Ten, you want as many teams that have 2-1 or 0 losses as possible. And if Oregon wins this game, I think there's a better chance Indiana ends up with 3 losses than if Indiana wins. Oregon, chances of Oregon losing 3 total, I think, is pretty slim. So if I'm the Big Ten, I want Indiana to win this game just from a numbers perspective for the CFP.
Wake Forest at Oregon State, Jake Dickert's return. Nobody's talking about it because everybody's talking about 0-6 Oregon State, also 12:30 tomorrow on the CW. Is the travel for Wake Forest a burden? Will the Demon Deacons, you know, be a little flat for a game against a winless opponent? Those are my questions. What questions do you have in front of that Wake Forest Oregon State game?
Yeah, that's a big one. What is the motivation here for Wake Forest? It's the middle of their conference season. They just played at Virginia Tech. They go home. They got to turn around and go. I mean, that is a long trip from Winston-Salem to Corvallis, right? And it's not a conference game. And the opponent hasn't won a game. And then next week, you got SMU coming in to Winston-Salem, right? I just think this is a trap game for Wake Forest. I mean, to the extent Wake Forest can have a trap game, right? To me, this has kind of got it. Because what is their motivation? Meanwhile, you got to assume Oregon State's players haven't completely given up yet, and they want to win a game. They've been close the last two games, so maybe they'll break through. I think this is actually a good setup. You know, if all things being equal, neutral field, I think Wake Forest is better. But when you add in just the circumstances and the travel and the non-conference nature of this game for Wake Forest, I think it's actually a good spot for Oregon State.
Love to see Trent Bray get a W so we can talk about something else when he comes on my show besides them being 0-for.
Yeah.
You know how hard that is when you've covered Bay Area teams that, you know, historically have not had a good season here or there. It's just Groundhog Day every day talking about the same stuff, and you're just searching for a little something interesting to talk about. But when you're 0-6, it's a dumpster fire on top of a train wreck. It's lousy.
And then you add in all the issues they got off the field too. Yeah. And yeah, it's hard to find anything sunny to talk about with OSU. There's no doubt.
Washington State's going to Mississippi. This is a 9:45 a.m. game tomorrow on the SEC network. Mississippi is favored by 32.5. Lane Kiffin likes to run it up. How do you see this for Washington State? I think it's a tough couple weeks for the Cougs.
It is tough. There's no doubt. They go to Virginia the week after, yeah, right? I'm not even sure that they're coming home in between, to be honest. Look, Mississippi's got certainly they could win the game by 40 or 50 points, but they also are in a little bit of an interesting spot. Non-conference game right in the middle of SEC play. They have Georgia next week. Mm. So how locked in? And Kiffin's teams have lost games the last few years that you would think they shouldn't really lose, right? They can play down to their competition. I do wonder if a little bit of that will be at hand. I was trying to check when was the last time the Cougs were dogs by 32 points. And I went back, I think it was the 2008 season. They were like 42-point underdogs against USC. That was a great Pete Carroll team, maybe the best defense of the USC dynasty. And I want to say the Cougars were in the middle of the Paul Wolf era, and it was a bad situation. But you got to go more than 15 years since they've been underdogs like this. I actually like their chances to cover that spread. I don't think it'll be at all close in the fourth quarter, but we could see kind of a half-hearted effort by the Rebels.
Speaking of USC, they are hosting Michigan, and Sharon Moore came out and said, you know, the game's a sellout at the Coliseum because Michigan's coming. Lincoln Riley said, his comment back was, I don't really care what he says. This is the kind of game we expect Lincoln Riley and USC to lose. Do they get a breakthrough here against Michigan? How do you see that game?
I think that it's going to be tough for the Trojans. I just haven't seen them do the things you need to do to win a game like this. You know, Michigan does have a freshman quarterback, Bryce Underwood, but, you know, they've got players, and they're good at the line of scrimmage, and they're tough. USC, not tough, doesn't run the ball when they need to run the ball, makes mistakes that at the bad spots, can't hold fourth quarter leads, all those things. I'm not going to believe USC can win a game like this until I see them win it.
I think you're probably not alone on that. And finally, you got these two Utah-Arizona games where it's Arizona-BYU and it's Utah against Arizona State. Which of those two games are you more interested in?
Well, I think they're both really interesting for a lot of reasons. One of them is the backdrop of the Holy War. The Utah-BYU game is next weekend. So both of those teams have kind of got a little bit of a look-ahead situation. I think that ASU at Utah could be the game of the day, like nationally. I just think, you know, it has the potential to be like a 31-30 barn burner, well-played, back-and-forth type deal. To me, that could be the game of the day for sure. I think I like ASU to actually figure out a way to win. They've just got a lot of moxie, and they have played so many close games already. They're not going to be bothered by the environment. They just dealt with the cowbells at Mississippi State. So I think definitely that's the game of the day, and I like ASU's chances.
Yeah, I had the same thing. I think I said 28-27 or 31-30, something like that, a one-point game, really tight. And that's even acknowledging that Sam Leavitt, the Arizona State quarterback, is listed as doubtful. That says a lot about the moxie of Arizona State. I'll take Utah at home in a close one, but Kenny Dillingham, we've seen him do some inspiring things with Arizona State so far. Wilner, thanks for joining us every Friday, and let's have a good ride down to Eugene tomorrow.
Sounds good, my friend. I will see you tomorrow.
All right, thank you. All right, there he goes, John Wilner, Bay Area News Group, San Jose Mercury News. You can see my picks at johnconzano.com. Give me your picks as well in the comment section there. Coming up, we're going to lead you right into Mariners, Tigers, Game 5 of the American League Divisional Series. Who's going on to the ALCS? We will find out coming up. We have the game right here on 750 The Game. On that note, we're going to talk some baseball leading into the Mariners, and I'll leave you with some parting thoughts on this great Friday. You got the bald-faced truth statewide. Leave it here.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
They say that there's no crying in baseball, but will there be tears in Seattle one way or another after tonight's Game 5 against the Detroit Tigers? You're going to hear it right here coming up on 750 The Game. First pitch coming up just after the top of the hour here. On yesterday's show, I had former Seattle PI columnist Jim Moore on the program, and I asked Jim what it would mean to him and to people in Seattle if the Mariners do break through, not just tonight in the ALDS, but how about getting to a World Series? How about winning a World Series? Here's what Jim said.
Well, it would mean everything, John. There have just been long-suffering Mariner fans, and a couple of weeks ago I wrote a column for the News Tribune in Tacoma, and I interviewed my own mom. And I normally wouldn't do something like that, but I thought that she was a good example of someone who's been waiting and waiting and waiting. And she's 96 years old, and this team got to town in 1977. And so however many years that is, what is that? I mean, 48, 49 years, where it's the only team in Major League Baseball that's never been to a World Series. And they've always been known as a losing franchise, and no one pays attention to them up in Seattle. And it would just, you know, they showed a guy crying the other day when there was a big hit by Julio in Game 2. And I think there's going to be a lot of tears in Seattle. God, I might even cry.
People don't know. I mean, Jim Moore was like a 17-year-old kid when the Seattle Pilots came to town in Seattle, and then they left to go on become the Milwaukee Brewers. And then certainly people in Seattle waited for baseball. And, you know, I've talked all week about how long people in Portland have waited for baseball. I'm not sure that there's a thirst in the way that Seattle was thirsting for baseball, but there's certainly a desire in Portland and a group in Portland that's trying to get it together. I was contacted by a television station in Salt Lake City last week. They're coming out to Portland on Monday, and they asked if I'd sit down for an interview to kind of talk about the battle going on between Salt Lake City and Portland as it comes to the Portland Diamond Project. Certainly, the Portland Diamond Project got a huge victory over the summer when the state legislature voted, or the lawmakers in the state of Oregon voted to approve a bill that expanded the original $300 million bond to $800 million, governor signing that into law. So there's the potential for $800 million towards a stadium project there in Portland. Certainly, that was a big win for Craig Cheek and the Diamond Project and Mike Barrett and everybody involved in that project. And but I kind of pushed back against the people in Salt Lake City. Like, everybody always wants to make it, it's us or them. Which one will Rob Manfred or Major League Baseball pick? I don't really see it that way. I think if baseball is wise, baseball will want the two best markets available, regardless if both are in the western part of the United States or eastern part of the United States, north or south. I don't think that matters as much as the viability of the markets. If you're really thinking about this as Major League Baseball opening two new franchises, you don't go, hey, we want to open one franchise in the West and one in the East. And, you know, never mind, we're going to have to pick between, you know, we're going to have to leave the second best option untapped because, you know, geographically they're too close together. I don't think baseball is going to think that way. I think what baseball is really looking for is not just an expansion, but a realignment. Travel has become such a cost prohibitive thing in sports. And we talk about it as it pertains to college sports, but certainly professional leagues are also looking at travel costs, particularly when you're a baseball club that's traveling and staying multiple days in a city, and then you're picking up and you're going on to somewhere else. I do think baseball would use this as an opportunity, not just to expand, but to realign and to try to rectify some of the things geographically that don't make sense. And I do think having Portland and Seattle and Salt Lake City, and you certainly have other clubs on the western part of the United States, the, you know, the Vegas is in transition with the A's, and I think you have a chance to really realign and create divisions. Like, what is Houston doing in the American League West? Like, that should be not an American League West team. So I think as I look at this, not just as a potential for, you know, Major League Baseball to go, hey, we want to add two new franchises. I look at it like, hey, can you fix some of the glaring problems? Like having Houston and Texas in the West, like the A's and the Angels make sense. The Mariners make sense. Would Salt Lake City and Portland not just round out the American League West? And then you take Houston and Texas and you go, okay, maybe those are more central type teams. Or if you're just going to add one in the American and one in the National, you know, maybe only one of them comes in and the other goes out. But I do think it's a really interesting opportunity to create, you know, more uniform divisions, or just, you know, do you have to have an American League East, Central, and West? Do you go to two divisions? Do you go to four divisions in the American League and the National League when you add two new teams? I think there's a lot there to think about, because, you know, you're talking about going from 15 teams in the American League and National League to going to 16 teams in the American League and National League. So now all of a sudden you have the potential to go four divisions of four teams instead of three divisions of five teams in each league, American and National. So I push back against the people in Salt Lake City. They're still coming out. Their ABC affiliate in Salt Lake City is doing this big sweeps piece on, hey, is it going to be Salt Lake City or is it going to be Portland? But my argument is, like, Salt Lake City's a more evolved animal. Like, I'm willing to acknowledge, like I can see it. Like, they've got an ownership group. You've got, you know, you have an ownership group, you have, you know, a better shot. You have the potential there, though, with Salt Lake City, with an NBA, a recent NHL team, college sports. You got a lot of competing entities there. The concern I have in Portland largely revolves around the Trailblazers, because there's only so much political will in the marketplace. And I do think it's going to take some political will and some political capital to do what Tom Dundon's group wants to do with the Blazers. They want to develop the area around Moda Center. They have not talked about it publicly, but it's clearly the play that they come in, they buy the team, they get control of the franchise, and then they go to the city and go, hey, we need improvements in the building or we're going to move. And the city goes, yes, we'll help you with improvements and infrastructure and some development around Moda Center that makes that a big-time winner for Dundon's group. But the same play is going on with Craig Cheek and the Diamond Project. Like, they want to attack the South waterfront. And if Portland's smart, it does both things, just like I'm advocating for Major League Baseball to do both things. Portland can go left hand, right hand. How do we do this? What great bookend projects this would be to have sort of a real redevelopment around Moda Center and a development on the South waterfront, which is just this kind of this hole, this gaping hole that is on the south side of the city. And so I think it would be like a shot in both arms for Portland, a shot in both arms for Major League Baseball. But certainly I think people in Salt Lake City trying to position this at least for now as, oh, this is it can only be one thing or the other. It can only be one or the other. I would encourage you to think about that as you listen to today's Mariners game right here on 750 The Game. It's a big game. A lot of enthusiasm in Seattle. It's a home game. Mariners up against a lot, not just up against the, you know, the best pitcher in the American League, but they're up against all that history, almost 50 years of history and overcoming so many shortcomings and shortfalls and pitfalls and trips and falls on their face that they've had over the years. I relate a little bit as a San Francisco Giants fan who largely watched my team struggle in the 1980s. And, you know, finally the Giants broke through and got to a World Series in 1989, and it was enough that they got there. The Bay Bridge Series, 1989, there was an earthquake. You ran into Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire and the Bash Brothers. But for me, it was such validation to see my team finally break through after so much losing, so much heartache. I think there will be tears either way for Mariners fans after this game. I'm hoping they're tears of joy. I'm hoping glassy eyes for Mariners fans. I feel for you. Fist bump to you, high five to you, good luck to you, step over the foul line, don't walk under a ladder. Don't, you know, if you're a superstitious person today, sit in the same spot on the couch when the Mariners get ahead in this game and don't move until they get the final out. But it's that kind of feel in Seattle in the Pacific Northwest. Incredibly excited for Mariners fans. All right, have a great weekend, everybody. We got big college football, of course, NFL. We've got the Mariners, who hopefully will be playing in the American League Championship Series Game 1 on Sunday, Game 2 on Monday. Should be a lot of fun. The Bald-Faced Truth is not here for a long time, just a good time. You know where to find me. You can find the podcast of the show wherever you get a podcast. And make sure you're reading me at johnconzano.com. Get a free subscription. Get a paid subscription. Whatever works for you works for me.